The content of this program is intended for blind and print-impaired audience. A warm hello to all our listeners, and welcome to today's program. This is Alida Khan from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from multiple sources, including History.com, Glamour Magazine, the December 2016 issue, ThePowerOfPositivity.com, and the Huffington Post, the Wellness section. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. And so let's begin today with, today is February 2nd, and it is Groundhog Day. The first Groundhog Day was recorded in 1887. On this day in 1887, Groundhog Day, featuring a rodent meteorologist, is celebrated for the first time at Gobbler's Knob in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. That's Punxsutawney. According to tradition, if a groundhog comes out of its hole on this day and sees its shadow, there will be 6 more weeks of winter. No shadow means an early spring. Groundhog Day has its roots in the ancient Christian tradition of Candlemas Day. That's C-A-N-D-L-E-M-A-S. When clergy would bless and distribute candles needed for winter, the candles represented how long and cold the winter would be. Germans expanded on this concept by selecting an animal, the hedgehog, as a means of predicting weather. Once they came to America, German settlers in Pennsylvania continued the tradition, although they switched from hedgehogs to groundhogs, which were plentiful in the Keystone State. Groundhogs, also called woodchucks, and whose scientific name is Marmota monax, typically weigh 12 to 15 pounds and live 6 to 8 years. They eat vegetables and fruits, whistle when they are frightened or looking for a mate, and can climb trees and swim. They go into hibernation in the late fall. During this time, their body temperatures drop significantly. Their heartbeats slow from 80 to 5 beats per minute, and they can lose 30% of their body fat. In February, male groundhogs emerge from their burrows to look for a mate, not to predict the weather, before going underground again. They come out of hibernation for good in March. In 1887, a newspaper editor belonging to a group of groundhog hunters from Punxsutawney, again called the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club, declared that Phil, the Punxsutawney groundhog, was America's only true feather forecasting groundhog. The line of groundhogs that have since been known as Phil might be America's most famous groundhogs, but other towns across America now have their own weather-predicting rodents, from Birmingham Bill to Staten Island Chuck to Shubenacadie Sam in Canada. In 1993, the movie Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray, popularized the usage of Groundhog Day to mean something that is repeated over and over again. Today, tens of thousands of people converge on Gobbler's Knob in Punxsutawney each February 2nd to witness Phil's prediction. The Punxsutawney Groundhog Club hosts a 3-day celebration featuring entertainment and activities. And now from Glamour Magazine, we have this article, Nadia Murad, the woman who stood up to ISIS. Well, actually, no, I am going to change that. It appears there is a section that is missing. So we will move to, again, How to Own Your Own Power, also from Glamour Magazine. These are tips that every woman of the year has to learn to gain confidence, and here are Christine Lagarde's tips. Get over your flaws. If you are a little bit overweight, that's fine. If you have gray hair, so be it. If you have big feet, so be it. I'm a size 11. It's about being reconciled with yourself and projecting yourself to friends at work as you are. And tip number 2, find your physical power. I do feel secure or insecure quite often, actually like all of us. But I have been lucky enough to be able to rely on physical strength, says Christine, which I think matters a lot. I practice yoga at a very early age, and I would say that breathing is critically important, as is relying on the physical strength that was given to you. Tip number 3. Develop confidence hacks. My grandfather used to say, even the king goes to the loo. When you walk into a boardroom, when you take the floor and speak, you can imagine the audience in all kinds of situations. We are all human beings. Just be human. As a young girl, I was a bossy boots. I am not ashamed of that. I am equally extremely emotional sometimes. I can cry when I watch something that's moving, and that is nothing to be ashamed of either. To repress one side of yourself, I think, is a mistake. And here is an interesting article from Glamour Magazine, 2016 edition, entitled, What We Believe. 82% of us say religion plays an important role in our lives, so why aren't we talking about it? 6 women kickstart the conversation here. As told to Mickey Halpin. I asked my rabbi, what will become of me? This is from Virginia Heffernan, 47, the author of Magic and Loss. In my 20s, I called myself a moderately devout Episcopalian. I had a sturdy faith, but I went to church only on Easter or Christmas. Then my fiancé, who was raised as an Oxford Orthodox Jew and wanted his children to be matrilineally Jewish, asked me to convert before we married. And so, at age 33, I began converting to conservative Judaism. It's a complex process. As part of the ritual, the rabbi turned me away 3 times. I had to study the Torah for a year and reject holidays like Christmas. At first, I thought my conversion would be like moving from Illinois to Indiana, a practical adjustment. But it was much stranger, like moving from Illinois to the color blue. A prayer from childhood would come to mind, and I would think, no, no, you're Jewish now, you can't do that. Converting tore me up inside and caused tension in my marriage. My husband wanted me to try harder. I wanted him to appreciate what I had already done, learned, and given up. Our marriage ended, and when it did, I went to my rabbi and asked, what will become of me? He looked very sad. Eventually, I decided to go back to the Episcopal Church. For Episcopalians, conversion can be as simple as accepting Jesus. But because the Jewish conversion was so arduous, I liked the idea of making the passage back with a ceremony called reconciliation. My priest put his hand on my forehead and said, "You're forgiven for apostasy or turning my back on my religion, and you never need to be forgiven again. I still cry when I think about it." In coming back to the church, I feel like I have returned home. Now my belief is a blend of Christian contemplative traditions with Eastern meditative practices. And I know this is trippy, but as someone who has always found a mysticism in the idea of collective unconscious, I also put faith in the internet. I have found relief from loneliness and inspiration online. Wherever you find faith, appreciate it. We want to raise kids who are confidently Muslim. After having their son, Fariha Molvi, 28, a writer from Los Angeles, and her husband, Muhib, are negotiating how their family will practice Islam. My husband and I have started by melding our family's traditions. We share a commitment to the 5 pillars of Islam, like prayer 5 times a day and fasting during Ramadan. But there are variations in the way those practices play out. For instance, my husband's family does the evening prayer as a group. My family does that only during Ramadan or when schedules permit. I want to take on that nightly tradition as a family when our son Aziz gets older. Some things are a little more difficult to blend, like whether our son will only eat specially prepared zabiha meat, like my family, or eat zabiha at home, but anything except pork when we go out, like my husband's family. So that's a conversation. Are we going to make him choose? We also think how we can raise children who are confidently Muslim. After 9/11, I'm used to having to be a spokeswoman for my faith. I hope my children will never need to do that. But if they do, I will tell them to say, I am just as American as you are, like I do. As I have gotten older and married and become a mother, my faith has grown with me. I take real joy in navigating all of this with my husband and discovering what Islam will be like for our family. You can be silly while striving for holiness. Catholic Katie Beardmore, 32, a religion teacher, and Michaela Glafke, 29, a substitute teacher of Indiana, perform as nun and nunner at Nun and Nunner on Instagram to spread the word and joy. Katie Beardmore says, we like to say we're sisters in life, sisters in Christ. Michaela Glafke says, together we are nun and nunner, which is our act, where we dress up like nuns, sing, and tell jokes. People book us for parties and retreats. We introduce ourselves as members of a made-up order. Lately, we're the Passionate Missionary Sisters, PMS. We let people know we aren't really nuns. The main point of our show is to give people joy. Life can be hard. We all need levity. If people find God in what we do, that's great. If they just find laughter, that's great too. When I was in school, it seemed like all the people who taught me about faith were mean. Even today, when people talk about a God who is vindictive and hissing, sinner, I'm like, we ain't talking about the same guy. I see God giving us the biggest party, and our duty is to dance and live life to the fullest. Frankly, I just have fun playing a role with one of my best friends. You can be silly while striving for holiness. I need to find something, but so far I haven't found anything, says Dianca London, 29, a Brooklyn-based writer. She says her childhood experience as a Baptist left her cynical about religion. I'm black, and I grew up in an all-white suburb. I went to a predominantly white fundamentalist Baptist school up to eighth grade, where I experienced racism and bullying. Some of the white kids excluded me from playground games because I looked different and laughed at my black Barbies because they didn't look like theirs, among other things. Outside school, my parents wanted to expose me to more of a black Baptist experience, and we belonged to a lot of congregations over the years. But I didn't fit in at the black churches either. I didn't listen to the same music as the other kids, who were into different things. When I was 15, someone at my youth group at one of these churches threw a Snapple bottle and hit me in the head. I felt like everything and everyone hated me. I told my parents, I'm done. I've tried to revisit religion in a formal setting. I went to a hipster church, but even that seemed insincere and full of petty squabbles. Sometimes when I walk by churches on Sundays, I hear people praying, and I miss that ritual. If I could find the right community, maybe I would try again. But so far, I haven't found anything that's right for me. And Rabbi Eliana Yokel, 39, of Washington, D.C., says that she became a conservative Jew and lost friends over it. She wanted to be a different kind of Jew than her family. I was raised an Orthodox Jew, which people think of as very strict. But religion never felt like an imposition to me when I was a kid. Occasionally, I felt I was missing out, like when I couldn't go out with friends on Friday night because of the Sabbath. But questioning it in a deep way never came up for me. By the age of 23, Orthodox Judaism began to feel limiting to me. It didn't address the way I saw myself and the way I believe the Torah should be applied in our world today. I wanted to be part of a faith that embraced change while honoring tradition, one that didn't limit the role of women in leadership, and one that didn't believe there was something fundamentally wrong with gay people. So I left Orthodox Judaism and became a conservative Jew. I chose a path that felt more authentic to the Torah I grew up with, a Torah of kindness and compassion. It wreaked a lot of havoc emotionally for my parents, because their community was very judgmental. I lost friends, and my parents lost friends over it, but I held firm, and I even decided to become a rabbi. Around the same time, I came out as a lesbian to my friends and family. Even though conservative Judaism was more welcoming to the gay community and to women, I had to stay closeted at my rabbinical school and during part of my first job as a rabbi, because there was a prohibition against gay and lesbian rabbis. That stricture has since been lifted, so I have seen firsthand how a synagogue can maintain tradition while innovating. That's one of the reasons I decided to become a rabbi. I felt like I could help shape something different. I hope I am uniquely prepared to reach out to folks who might feel placed on the margins and help them access Jewish wisdom, to help them feel welcome, accepted, and loved. And now, let's turn to thepowerofpositivity.com, and here is an article entitled, Six Things Grateful People Do Differently. Most of us have known grateful people, as well as people who are less than grateful for the things in their lives. Meeting those polar personalities can make you wonder what daily habits make grateful in the first place. It also might make you think, how can I avoid a lack of gratitude? No one wants to be bitter, angry, resentful, or lonely, but a pattern of negative habits is what creates that type of personality. The good news is that we can unlearn bad habits and replace them with good ones so that we are more grateful for the things we have each day. Let's look at some of the positive behaviors that you can start incorporating to avoid an attitude of ungratitude. These habits, practiced often, can make you a more grateful person. A habit is something that you repeatedly spend time doing, and breaking them can be hard. It is easier to add another new habit than to eliminate a bad one, so start right away building habits of gratitude. Eventually, all negative habits will go away as they are replaced by the good feelings that grateful habits give you. Remind yourself that you are responsible for your own happiness. You are only a victim if you let yourself be victimized. If you are in a situation that makes you unhappy, recognize that you have the power to move, act, and stand up for yourself. Say to yourself, if I am unhappy, I can choose to go away from this person or situation. If you choose to stay with someone who makes you unhappy or in a place that makes you unhappy, you have decided that this is what is best for you right now. Deciding that not acting is what is best for you is like saying that you are grateful for the experience of knowing what you dislike, so that you know better what you do like and can choose to find more of that in the future. Turn your vulnerability into strength. We all have strengths and weaknesses about our personalities. Of course, we want to build on our strengths and learn from our weaknesses, but realize what a gift your vulnerabilities are. Brené Brown writes in her book, "Vulnerability sounds like truth and feels like courage. Truth and courage aren't always comfortable, but they are never weakness. Admit your faults to others and ask for help to improve on them. Let them see that you are not perfect, but that you know how to use your imperfections to become a better person. You would never blame someone else for your flaws, because without them, you wouldn't be the complete person who you are today. Make meaningful connections with people. Gratitude is an attitude of being thankful for the life experiences that you have received and the lessons learned from them. Sharing these experiences with others helps us to solidify the lessons we have received, as well as to hear the life lessons that others have received. Researchers studying gratitude found that it was associated with positive mood, good social connections, well-being, and spiritual connectedness. Brené Brown says, "I define connection as the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment, and when they derive sustenance and strength from the relationship." Spend time with those who are suffering. A hospital, a homeless shelter, a community food bank. There are opportunities for you to experience what it is like to live with far less than you now have, and everything that should make you grateful. seeing the disparity between you, between what you have and what others live without, is one way to avoid the habits that make people ungrateful. Write down what you are grateful for. Researchers looked at the effect of a grateful outlook on psychological and physical well-being. They found that a conscious focus on blessings by writing them down may have emotional and interpersonal benefits. Participants were told, there are many things in our lives, both large and small, that we might be grateful about. Think back over the past week and write down on the lines below up to 5 things in your life that you are grateful or thankful for. Participants in the study gave the following examples of gratitude-inducing experiences. Waking up this morning. The generosity of friends. To God for giving me determination. For wonderful parents. For the Lord for just another day. To the Rolling Stones. As another example of how you might do this at home, the author's successful sister keeps a gratitude jar on her counter and makes a habit of writing several things she is grateful for each day on slips of paper. The jar is opened at the next New Year's Day, and she spends time celebrating the previous year's blessings. And always remember to always be thankful. Life could be worse. And now also from Glamour magazine, we have an interview with Michelle Obama, or these are snippets from past interviews. And they are entitled, Thank You, FLOTUS, for your example, for your authenticity, and most of all, for your damn good advice. Michelle Obama is a hugger. We at Glamour learned this back in 2007 when we first met her on the campaign trail for her husband, then Senator Barack Obama. She extended her arms along with a smile. In the 10 years that have followed, Mrs. Obama has sat down with Glamour 5 more times, most recently on the International Day of the Girl this past fall. Girls worldwide joined via Skype and asked FLOTUS, whom one called the First Lady of the World, their questions about confidence, her Let Girls Learn initiative, and her favorite novel. By her words and example, Michelle Obama has taught women and girls everywhere to be proud of their intelligence, to speak their minds, and to advocate for themselves and others. As she leaves the White House, we're revisiting her best Glamour moments. What will Mrs. O do next? One request, memoir, please. On nailing a job interview, Michelle Obama says, we as women don't like to talk about ourselves. This is one time where you have to brag a little bit. You've got to pump your chest out. You've got to wheel out your bag of goodies. You've got to pull yourself out of the team and shine a light on yourself. On prioritizing yourself, Michelle says, I have always tried to put my kids first and then put myself a really close second, as opposed to fifth or seventh. One thing I've learned from male role models is that they don't hesitate to invest in themselves with the view that if I'm healthy and happy, I'm going to be a better support to my spouse and children. And I found that to be the case. On reframing labels, Michelle says, aggressive, that's the word that has been used for me often. Too aggressive, too loud, too bossy. Well, aggressive is assertive. Loud is confidence. It's how you take those words. Maybe they were said to you or about you in a negative light, but you turn them around and you make them positive attributes. Because, let me tell you, to compete, you're going to have to be aggressive, and you've got to be confident, and there are times when you need to be loud and speak your mind. I've had to do that in every room of power that I've sat in. On finding an equal partner, Michelle says, Barack was always special, you know, and not special like he's going to be important, he's going to be president. He was special in terms of his honesty, his sincerity, his compassion for other people. Cute's good, but cute only lasts for so long, and then it's who are you as a person? Don't look at the bank book or the title. Look at the heart. Look at the soul. Look at how the guy treats his mother and what he says about women. And more important, how does he treat you? Good advice from Michelle Obama. And from Glamour magazine again, from the January 2017 edition, here is an article entitled, Work Mistakes to Avoid in 2017. The office, if you've even in an office, can be a confusing place these days. A few life lessons here by Bess Levin. You've probably heard these workplace adages: don't leave before your boss or curse at the office, and definitely don't get drunk at the holiday party. We're not saying those rules don't apply anymore. Let's be real. It's never kosher to knock down multiple cosmos in the same room as the person who determines your salary. But things have changed. You're more likely to hear people drop an F-bomb while on the clock. Research shows it can actually bring employees closer, and a younger workforce is blurring hierarchical lines. So how should you behave now? Heed this advice. Don't wait to do great work. Stuck at a job you don't love? Yep, been there. Young people now are more likely to be underemployed than past generations. But the biggest mistake you can make is to act like you're above the menial tasks you're given, says Deborah Rivera, founder of the Succession Group, an executive search consulting firm. I've seen employees who aren't even trying to excel, she says. They think, when I start my real job, I'll do well. But no one will recommend you if you don't take your current one seriously. Find value in every task and do it better than everyone else. Don't talk expletive on the record. A client asked me for some recommendations for an ad agency, says Jackie K., 45, a communications director in Westport, Connecticut. So I reached out to a great agency and wrote about my client's existing publicity campaign. My client needs you. You've probably seen this hideous ad around the city. When the agency said yes and I forwarded their contact info to the client, that little tidbit was forwarded as well. The client called my boss to complain. Thankfully, my boss was nice about it. He reminded me to be careful, but I learned a valuable lesson. Nowadays, everyone does work on their phone, where it can be harder to see an entire email thread. If you're not sure, don't forward. Just start a new chain to be safe. And this article will have to be edited for time. And from the internet website factsrandomhistory.com, here is a tidbit on human emotions and instincts. Emotional abuse is similar to brainwashing in that it attempts to systematically wear away a person's self-confidence, self-worth, and self-concept. Emotional abuse can take many forms, including using economic power to control, threatening to leave, degrading, belittling, continually criticizing, name-calling, or shouting. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope you are enjoying our revamped format and broader content presentations intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we look forward to hearing your remarks. Be sure to listen next time. And remember that this broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. I am Alida Khan, reading to you for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, wishing you a lovely, safe, and productive week. Until next time, I leave you with this inspirational quote of the day. Logic will get you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere. By Albert Einstein. For comments, questions, or suggestions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Wishing you a beautiful day.